Blog Talk Radio.
Are back. Welcome to another episode of This Week in Accountable Care. I'm your host, Greg Masters, producer of the show, and This Week in Accountable Care is brought to you by Health Innovation Media, by the way. We need to get a little plug in there for our parent sponsor. And we have not been on the weekly schedule here as we've been busy in other respects on This Week in Health Innovation and This Week in Oncology, but we're getting back to it today. We've got an encore appearance by one of my favorite voices in the conversation, and that would be Mr. Bill DeMarco, William DeMarco to be exact. Bill's a seasoned veteran in the managed care space, having pioneered the early development of HMO's post-HMO Act, so he goes back that far with some nameplate properties, including United Healthcare. Bill is the president of Pendulum Healthcare Development Corp. and president and CEO of DeMarco & Associates. He's a certified management consultant in healthcare, and he specializes in new healthcare ventures and growth strategies with primary focus on feasibility and design work for communities. Hold on, everyone, if you're still with us. I'm getting back on the line with our guest, Bill DeMarco. Okay. So let me just say that Skype is great when it works. Okay. Bill? Very good. Can you hear me? I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can't hear you.
Okay. Okay, let's see. It's 619-393-2836.
Are you there?
Oh. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay.
Now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I just put in the guest call in number 619-393-2836. If we lose you again. Just try that, and if we have continued technical difficulties, we will reschedule. But
all right. Say the number again.
619-393-2836.
Okay, that's Plan B.
Yes, okay. That's Plan B. Okay. So I think we got most of the introduction in. And the last time we chatted, it was a while back, and we were talking about this impending ACO explosion, and you were of the mindset that there's a lot more going on, and if you widen the net up to and including managed care entities like Medicare Advantage contractors, that portion of the beneficiary world, both commercial and private, I think we lost you. Are you still there, Bill? Okay, we're going to go to Plan B, everyone. This is a first, I must say. This is very interesting. So while we're waiting for Bill to call back in, I'm going to try and finish my thought there, which was Bill is an advocate of the worldview that in light of the sort of mixed tea leaf sentiment around accountable care organizations, you had the pro camp, Elliot Fisher, Mark McClellan, Don Berwick, you know, and many others, as well as their health plan.
Greg,
Bill, I can hear you. And I was just setting the context about last time we talked that you were of the mindset that there's a bigger picture here in terms of accountable care and look at the history, including what's going on in the commercial space, as well as the participation in the Medicare Advantage program. If you couple that with sort of the metrics around, certified ACOs from CMS perspective, there was a much wider population here that first seemed. And it got a little cross with Jeff Goldsmith, who took a different opinion and so forth. Anyway, since that time, are you there, Bill?
I'm here.
Okay. Since that time, there are funny things happening on my switchboard, which I cannot explain. This is the first, so if this is persistent technical difficulties, we'll reschedule. But let's assume we're still connected, because it looks like we are. Let's just update, in light of the CMS announcement recently about the changes in the participation of 9 members in the class of 32 of the Pioneer program. Let's start with that. Tell us first up, what's the Pioneer class, and what are we to make of the news that was posted a while back by CMS? Give us your take.
Well, the Pioneers were supposed to be the larger groups with larger resources, mostly physician groups, a lot of AMGI members who I think had a great influence in helping to rewrite some parts of the proposed law so that physicians would be able to get their arms around it and do well. So I think there were some good things that happened with that particular group as leaders for us. The Pioneer rules were a little different than the traditional Medicare shared savings in that they were able to take a little bit bigger chunk from the Medicare dollar than the standard Medicare shared savings. And as a result of that, they would be also taking a little bit more risk. So they had more like a track two type arrangement with risk on the bottom and risk on the top. Well, that's great. If you've been a multi-specialty group that has done work like this before, has managed risk, and most of these big groups have, but to try and do it in a year or less, to try and gear up to actually do that, that's a very, very hard thing to do. My guys here in Rockford, we had a large multi-specialty group practice. It took at least 4 years for the group to really settle on seeing where some of these savings worked to their advantage, and that they were able to build some capacity that they didn't have before, and that they were actually able to see the advantage of having their own product here. But they had to then also learn risk. So this is not unusual. You're dealing with a corporate culture in a lot of these cases where some of the groups say, gee, we can do this because we're big and we have these resources. And some of the groups will say, well, we've got actual experience in doing this. And then some of the groups, they don't really get out of the starting box real quick. And as a result of that, they may be 6-7 months into the program, and they haven't even submitted data yet. And the CMS folks are saying, where is your data? And they're starting to come to the realization maybe they made a rash decision or rushed into it a little bit too soon, in which case they can still stay in the ACO program. They can go to this Medicare shared savings level where they're only dealing with top-end risk, meaning that if they create savings, they share in savings with Uncle Sam. But there were a couple that didn't make it even to that point for various reasons that I'm not totally aware of. But the idea being that after you've been doing this for a year, if you're not generating results or at least making some very strong strides forward, you're probably going to have problems in the future. And as you and I both know, working with physicians and hospitals, right there, there's a potential communication gap and or conflict, in which case it's better that they pull backwards and then maybe start again next year or when they're ready to manage the risk a little bit. Greg? Uh-oh. This is not our day, my friend.
Bill, I'm sorry, I was on mute.
You had it on mute?
Not even,
oh, okay.
Yeah,
so you didn't get it.
Right. No, but I got all that. So I what I was having a conversation with myself, but I was saying, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but so where do you come down on the side of this, the battle for the control of the narrative? I heard what you just said, but which camp would you be advocating from?
Well, I think that the idea is that whenever there's a journey like this that starts, and a lot of people still refer to it as a program, and I think you had an excellent show here recently where that was part of the gist of things, saying people have to look at this as truly a journey. And if they're not prepared, if they don't have their backpack packed and they don't have a good map, they're probably better just to stay home until they're ready to do this. So I come down on the narrative saying that any kind of a journey like this, you're going to have a few that are going to take a detour or fall aside just by virtue of the fact that it is something that is very difficult to do. You've got culture as probably one of the key indicators. People ask me what is the leading cause of death of ACOs, and I say non-alignment of physicians. Then that was the case with PHOs. It was the case with clinical integration. It was the case with early provider-sponsored HMOs. This is where the physicians have to be aligned around a vision and have that map before they leave the campsite. Otherwise, they're in serious trouble. The other side of the narrative where there's a lot of negative on ACOs, and I think that kind of flows back into the government's frustration with their own inability to communicate some of these points effectively. I think that's a narrative that we're going to continue to hear, but it also indicates that where we were 3 years ago, there was not even ACO legislation. 2 years ago, we had no ACOs. Now we're just coming up on the first graduating class here, and there's over 400, 500 ACOs that are out there. So it's not like this is a real bad situation. I think it's something that you have to accept with any kind of a new journey that people go on.
Yeah, that's great. And I think as Jim Hansen over at the Accountable Delivery System Institute of Humaris operation pointed out that, yes, this is a journey, and to actually not forget that the bottom line here is there was $33 million in net savings generated for the Medicare Trust for Medicare Trust Fund. So I think it's interesting, if you just were to scan the headlines, you'd get a sense of how people come up on this. For instance, the Kaiser Health News headline is 9 Pioneer ACOs Jump Ship After First Year. You know, whereas the indicia of the actual group performance is 2 will leave the CMS ACO program altogether, 7 will eliminate downside risk by reapplying under the terms of the standard Medicare Shared Savings Program, so technically they're not exiting as an ACO. 32 of the 32, 100%, improved quality of patient care and rated highly on patient satisfaction scores. You know, and there was, 140 million in total savings, 52.4 in total losses, and 76 in shared savings to be returned to the 13 pioneers, and that's the net of the 33. So, you know, if one were to say, hey, put the dashboard up and let's do a deeper dive into the metrics here, that's a pretty interesting story, no?
It is. It's a very interesting story, and it goes back to my earlier point saying that as these pioneers and the other ACOs, and now we're seeing hospitals are now saying, hey, it's safe to get in the water. We're going to give this a good shot because we can't really stand on the sideline anymore. So all of those groups, we're changing Medicare permanently in terms of both the reimbursement as well as the incentives for really focusing in on issues of quality, which we now know, of course, does work. So the idea being that this kind of a program or this kind of a journey is going to impact 15 to 20% of the Medicare population, that's not unheard of. And I think when you add the Medicare Advantage program, which is still growing, you're really looking at almost 20% of the entire Medicare population being in a different delivery system with different incentives and different reimbursement schedules. All of the things that we talked about with clinical integration that for whatever reason didn't work, it is now starting to work, and it's with a population that really is very, very difficult to manage. And if we can do it here, we can do it just about anywhere, as they say. So I think this is a good note to let people know this is not easy to do. Not everybody can be an ACO or should be an ACO, but those that should, they're going to be really working hard at it and continue to really succeed in markets and bring some competition and some improved quality.
So I have to ask you, I mean, since you have a longitudinal view here, why is physician alignment so difficult?
Because of the way physicians are brought up and trained. They are trained to be very independent, especially the surgeons. There isn't somebody there they can beg on and say, gee, would you do this for me? They are really accustomed to be very independent thinkers and see themselves as both scientists and business people. And the more that we've had for-profit injected into the healthcare system, the more a lot of people are seeing, wow, there's a lot of different incentives running around that are maybe counter to delivering good care, just delivering a lot of care. And that's where I think we might have gotten off our original agenda, what we were trying to do with healthcare 20 years ago. But I think the physicians that are saying, I need to protect what I have here, and I also need to be able to make my own independent judgment and work forward. And so when you're saying build into a group, a lot of the physicians either have seen a group fail or they've been in an IPA that has not done well, or for whatever reason just don't see the value of collaborating with other groups. Now, that's changing little by little. We're working with a group on the East Coast right now where that's exactly what these specialists are doing. They don't want to be left out. At the same time, they don't want to sell themselves out to a single group. So they're forming a network MSO, and the MSO is going to provide a lot of centralized services and take a lot of extra time off of their desk where they've been doing paperwork and really be able to work with these ACOs. And there's a lot of other organizations, I think, specialty and otherwise, who can do that same thing. But I think there's a lot of independent streaks still there saying, I don't want to. You know, we had one in Cincinnati where we tried everybody to get the same brand of a lease car, and they really got a good, very, very good deal, but not everybody wanted a Buick. So it's just very hard to get everybody together in the same on the same piece of paper. But what I am seeing is a change in that, where a lot of the physicians have figured out, even if they've been very successful, that they've taken this so far, and they are not totally aware of all the things that are in this this Affordable Care Act. And so as a result of it, they're saying this is a whole new ballgame. They're seeing it as a scientist and as a business person. If this is what I have to do to protect what I've earned, then this is what I'll be willing to do. Complain about it? Yes. The fact of the matter is, it's an asset that they have in their head, and they've been able to make a good living at it, and now there are some change that needs to be put forward.
So, totally agree. I mean, there is a zeitgeist sentiment shift. There's no question about it. But back to the question of training and culture, basically, where's AAMC on this? Are they listening? If this is the go-to issue, why change has been so difficult, why this alignment quest has been so elusive, dating back to Henry Mayo's comment, you know, in the 20s about integration, is where's AAMC on this, and are they part of the solution, or are they just special interest part of the problem?
Well, it's hard to say. You're talking about the medical societies and the medical specialties. It's hard to say. I think some specialty groups, depending on where they are going to be fiercely independent. If you go to Texas, you go to some of these other groups, they're going to be fiercely independent. But now if you go to California, they're even coming back and saying, here are some of the things you can do. And some of the other single specialty organizations are saying, don't give up your single specialty, but there are ways to collaborate, build MSOs, build IPAs, whatever words. We're probably going to see some other letters to represent these specialty IPAs in a very short period of time. But there's a real advantage to that in terms of sharing overhead and expense. Some of these people have surgery centers that can do things very quickly and very effectively, so that it keeps it away out of the hospital. And so some of the specialists are saying, gee, these hospitals are competing with me by hiring all these specialists. I think I'm going to compete with them by going with these ASCs and going with some of my colleagues here. So I think you're seeing some evolution in some of the more busy markets, where a lot of these ACOs have started to really put down markers and say, this is where we are and where are you? And so they're going to have to say, gee, I'm going to vote for myself and protect my own self-interest here, but if I have to work with others to do it, all I want is to make sure that the others I'm working with are quality doctors. And that's what we want. We want that credentialing in the back of their head saying, I'm with a quality group. It isn't a group practice, but it's a good quality group. And if they can do that and through the specialty societies convey an opportunity to really share in the equity and the outcome of that that really improves patient safety, I think that's the piece we've been missing here for a while. Is people have been so much into cost controls and cost containment, and it makes the physicians just, you know, their stomachs just roll over and over again because cost containment means I'm going to have to give up some revenue. But now if we're starting to talk about patient safety, and this is where LeapFrog group was genius in terms of the way they work with the hospitals on safety issues, a lot of which are really quality issues. But you tie those two together, there isn't a physician out there that says, no, I want my patients to be unsafe. I want to back the safety situation. And I think that's where we need to get to.
So I think we can pretty much see where the so-called narrowly cast special interests of medical societies would come into play here, and that they might not be on the bleeding edge of innovation, as Eric Topol likes to say, that it will come from in spite of them and perhaps at the margins. But AAMC and the Association of Academic Medical Centers certainly have a role here. They're training the physicians of the future. If the old models are tired and worn out and don't work anymore, the question is what replaces it? And I have to say, I did a broadcast on this Crowds Care for Cancer ONC NCI sponsored challenge to develop apps for survivors. And I spoke with Patty Gans at UCLA, who's a joint appointment in oncology and epidemiology, and she's kind of at that interface of the psychosocial angle around the medical in caring for cancer patients, and a long-term player at UCLA, impeccable academic credentials. And it looked like she had a foot in both camps, you know, the new and different versus the old and maybe tired. And I asked her, what's your experience from your seat? Are you optimistic, or do you see things changing? And by that I meant, you know, the siloed nature, the departmental sacred cows where it's about empire building as opposed to cross-disciplinary fertilization. And she blew me away. She said, no, I'm not optimistic. I don't see much change. So if that's a proxy for what's going on the reengineering of the culture side, at least insofar as academic medical centers are concerned, well, what does that say?
Well, and it is something I know our physicians here, we've had a lot of discussions about, are we training an entire generation of physicians who are going to come out, and yes, they're going to use computers, and yes, they're going to use medical research, and they're going to use the latest findings, but they're just going to want a job. They're just going to want to work from 8 to 5 and, you know, maybe 4 days a week. And so is that what we really want to do? Because then we've really taken that independent streak out of medicine. And that's why I kind of couch it that way, to say that independent streak is not a bad thing for a clinician to have, because in the worst situation, it'll save them. But at the same time, you're looking at the business aspect of this to be something that can be shared in a lot of different ways. So I think somewhere between this idea that we're all going to be robots and put into groups, and then this whole idea where we're going to be cowboys and we're going to be out in the Wild West, somewhere in between there, we've got some physicians that I think are going to go into the group practices and say, you know, I'm not happy doing this the way that I thought I was going to be. And yes, for my lifestyle, it's wonderful. But, you know, my kids are grown now. I really don't need the shackles of the group practice. I want to go out and do X. And that's where I think you're going to get people that are going to have one leg in both worlds and get the issue you brought up in the psychosocial and the support and how do you effectively use primary care? How do you effectively use the mid levels? All of these things that we know work, and it's just now a matter of getting these laboratories to really get going. And that's what an ACO can be. It is a laboratory where we can try a lot of these different things. I have some ACOs that just swear on having embedded primary care case managers in every primary care practice that they have, and then I have others who say, no, we should be sending it to home care first, and then when home care calls us in, then we're going to coordinate from there. Both models are working. Now, how long, what's the durability on it? I don't know. But the fact of the matter is there's different experiments going on.
Right, and I hear this perhaps this lifestyle shift thing that's actually taking place where docs would rather hire up with a medical group or Kaiser than go out and solo practice. It looks like solo practice is a dying breed, but I'm wondering how many of these employment deals are going to blow up in the near term. So we're coming down on 2 minutes left, and I want to just run some of these names behind you because CMS named the pioneers are exiting, and I was a little surprised by some. I just want to get your take if any of them stand out. They are in order: Healthcare Partners California ACO, Healthcare Partners Nevada ACO, JSA Care Partners, I'm not familiar with them, Physician Health Partners Denver, PLUS, which is the North Texas Specialty Physicians and the Texas Health Resources Joint Venture, Presbyterian in Albuquerque, Prime Care Network Ontario, California, Seton Health Alliance in Austin, Texas, and the University of Michigan. Ann Arbor. Any of those names sound like, wow, why? Or, that's odd.
I know some of the folks. I know some of the folks that you read off there, and some of them are, just as we said, they didn't get out of the starting gate quick enough, and then 3-4 months later when they should have had all this agenda done, they don't have it done, and they're saying, wow, we should have conducted a feasibility study and really learned what we were getting into. I think that's part of it. And then there's some that are going to say, gee, you know, the physicians halfway through said, enough, you know, I don't want to hear any more about accountable care. You know, I want out of this. If we don't have to do it, then we shouldn't be doing it, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's room for both. But again, if their backpack is not packed and they don't have a good map, they shouldn't leave the campsite. Just any kind of business that you're in, this is why they made the ACO at this point optional. But that may change again.
There you go. If you don't have the backpack, you shouldn't be at the campsite. I love that visual. Okay, Bill, that's going to have to be the last word. My apologies for the technical difficulties we had. I want to thank my guest today, Bill DeMarco, President and CEO of DeMarco & Associates, and President at Pendulum Healthcare Development Corp. for his time today. We will do this weekly at This Week in Accountable Care. Please join us next week for another episode of This Week in Accountable Care. This is Greg Masters saying bye now. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks.
Revolutionary sway. Pull my head on, feel the pain. Just a puppet on.